All right, so we're back.
Well, there was one other spin-off from that, which is it showed how Anderson was so, why I admired him so much. We were going over to see Sir Gerald Templer.
Simon Templer, the Tiger of Malaya?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Gerald is what they called him in those days. Anyway.
In a nice way, or was it sort of a disparaging
term? Oh, no. Gerald Templer. Mm-hmm. He was the director of Notre Dame Intelligence.
Really?
At that time, yes.
Had he just come back from Malaysia, or?
Oh no, he hadn't gone yet.
No.
And I admired him tremendously. I was a fellow, but he was crippled, terribly crippled. He'd been helping move a piano down the stairs one time in the mess, and the darn thing had fallen on him,
mm-hmm.
and crushed its one side bad. Very pleasant though. But we went over there. And this was right after Ronnie McDonald, who I guess the first time Anderson and I went over, right afterwards, you see. And Anderson wrote over and said, what we wanted in the way of a successor, because we wanted somebody in particular qualifications. Went into Anderson and I said, you come with me. We're going to see Gerald Templer. You stick right with me. He said, if he just says, come on in, what we used to call him? Andy, I think we called him. Yeah, Andy. Anderson didn't like it at all. Anyway, so he says, Andy, come in there. He said, you come with me, because I want you to back me up. Now, he said, the one thing we got to do when we're in there, he said, we got to bring up the subject of Ronnie McDonald. Because he said, I want to really blast Templer from start to bottom, you see, on that. Templer was a very arrogant little fellow. And he was a good type. But anyway, we went in there, and... But one of the first things he said, well, Andy, he said, I have you know we're sending a good man out this time. Anderson said, and about time, too, that fellow asked. Ronnie McDonald, you see? But we got out, Anderson, handed it to me right on the planet. Oh, gosh. But Templer was we got on with him well, but he was a kind of a person who... Well, I think, generally speaking, my impression practically all the way through is that, in my whole brush with intelligence, was that with relation to the British, you had to be, just to put it bluntly, suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
With the Americans, it was never quite anything like that at all. They were always...
open.
Well, they were trying to help you. They weren't trying to put something over you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I to try and explain that was that I think the British have tried this on us, well, as many times as they thought they could get away with it. But they would say, now look, it, we can't both have attachés all around the world. Question of money. So why don't we divide up the attaché posts, and some places you have them, some places we have them. So Anderson, of course, without taking any time to think at all, said, excellent. I agree with that 100%. He said, we'll put all the attaché posts down on a list. He said, you'll have first choice, we'll have second choice. You'll have third, we'll have fourth. Never hear any more about it. They wanted the first 20 and give us the last 20, you see? Well, that was the way you had to watch them all the way through. It wasn't that they were going to deceive you. It was just that if...
They wanted the advantage.
They would take advantage of you if you were gullible enough to let them do it. And I give them full marks for it, too.
Mm-hmm.
For trying, but it just shows you the attitude you had to have when they came up with a proposition on...
The British are highly Machiavellian, aren't they?
Now the Americans are really, they're not like that. they wouldn't stoop to that kind of thing in a way.
Mm-hmm. Or if they did, you could see it a mile away.
Well, I think maybe we thought we would have, because we just didn't detect it. We didn't find ourselves in the wrong end of the stick on things. After having agreed with something with them, they were always pretty candid about something like that. And we never found it that way, that's all. It's just a matter of experience. Well, another more of a nice and interesting sidelight was one Miss Chartrand. Now, she was about 60, I guess, when I last saw her, 65, I suppose. But when I was the staff captain at the 3rd Canadian Infantry Brigade in Europe during World War II, the brigade major of the 3rd Brigade was Pat Bogart, Major Bogart. Now, he was a regular force RCR officer. And in the course of many conversations, he told me that he was the only intelligence officer in Ottawa before the war.
Mm-hmm.
Krier was the director of military operations, plans, and intelligence, or something like that. But under the tree, Bogert was the only one, and he had other duties besides being the intelligence officer.
Mm-hmm.
His sole duties consisted of mailing the British intelligence weekly, or whatever it was, I think it was a monthly in those days, out to the various headquarters and circulating it around. That's all he had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he had one person working for him, and that was Miss Chartrand. And all she ever did was she took the daily newspapers and extracted anything from them, made cutouts, pasted them onto sheets of paper, and circulated that around each day.
Mm-hmm.
And this was presumably supposed to be world events or anything that was taking place abroad or in Canada, that kind of thing, would interest military people.
Mm-hmm.
This was all Army. And the interesting point about it is that when I got there in 47, she was still there doing the same job. Now, I didn't have any use for newspaper cutouts in those days, so it was a very delicate thing to switch her over because she'd been doing that for ages. And I must say, she was extremely adaptable. We got her on to another task of which she became very proud, and eventually when she retired we had a big party for her and so on. The whole thing went out very well, but I sure had my misgivings in trying to shift her. After all that, I'd like to die. And she got so many compliments by everybody in the headquarters if they ever saw her, you know, on the street or anything. So, oh, Miss Chartrand, you know, everybody knew her because we got her name on this
mm-hmm.
sheet.
Was she an attractive woman, or was it that she was a motherly woman? Or?
Yeah, she was a very old maid type.
Yeah.
I think she was Miss Chartrand, she old maid.
Sounds like a history teacher at about the grade six level.
Yes. Well, another point was, again, the attitude on intelligence. When I had, Anderson asked me to do a review of our layout. I don't know whether I mentioned this to you or not. But anyway, he said, now, go over all the layout, assess where we need them and where we don't,
mm-hmm.
and come up with a brand new argument on all these posts, because we found that some of the posts weren't all that good
mm-hmm.
after having had experience in them. So things like Sweden and so on really weren't producing very much, compared with some we really wanted. So I did a completely new study, and it was sent up, and why I don't know, but Kitching, who was the Brigadier General Plans at that time, who had intelligence and plans and ops under him, he was Anderson's boss,
mm-hmm.
he sent for me to go down there and discuss this thing with him, because I guess he knew I'd written it. And Kitching I had known pretty darn well, because he was a captain at Div headquarters when I was a staff captain at 3rd Brigade, and he had to do with ranges, and somehow or other I got the job of dealing out ranges to my units and getting them on various ranges like small arms and mortar and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to deal with him on that, so I knew him well enough, kind of thing. We were equals, but he went over this thing, and he took a very jaundiced view about any of these posts. But he said, China, there, he said, you can stroke that one off right now. So I said, well, my criteria was that either it was going to be a potential enemy, a potential ally whom we knew wanted to know how well they'd fight if they were in there with us, or a straight friendly country, which we didn't really need an attaché. It's just a formality, that's all we had one there for, had to have one there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but most of the countries came in the first two, outside of UK and US. And he said, well, he said, I said, how can you be sure we're never going to fight against China? He said, I'll tell you why. He said, because I heard Charles Foch say so. Within 6 months, we had a brigade out there.
Fighting.
Well, that was the approach to intelligence. And mind you, I...
to use a phrase, would be covering my ass, or covering your ass. In other words, he didn't want to extend himself. If Foch said, all right, we don't have to worry about it, we won't, even though I think my own better judgment...
Could have been.
Was Kitching like that?
I have a very low opinion of Kitchen.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that he gave me some of the best advice and I acted on it in my life.
Well, the assumption that I have from... I've only met him once.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I've heard of him is that he was unjustly saddled with the problems at Falaise in 44, and that he had a lot dumped upon him, and that he was actually a very good officer who Simmons made a scapegoat of.
I didn't see it that way. I didn't see Falaise, and I don't know the details. But when I was first went to Italy, I was in a batch of reinforcement staff officers to be sent anywhere. And among one of the jobs that I got when I was there was I was in the operations staff at Corps headquarters. And Creer was commanding the Corps at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And before I got there, about maybe a few weeks, maybe a month, maybe only a week, before I got there, the infantry brigade of the 5th Armored Division, which had not seen any action up until then, was given the task of attacking on the Adriatic coast there, a certain area of ground, and to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And Kitching was the... Kitching had been the chief GSO1, General Staff Officer, Grade 1, Lieutenant Colonel, for Simmons when he was commanding the 1st Canadian Infantry Division in Sicily and Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he got the OBE or something like that, or the MBE, whichever is the most important. He got it on Simmons' say-so, and the sun rose and set on him, according to what everybody said. As far as Simmons was concerned, he got the OBE for carrying a message between two vehicles at the headquarters when the headquarters was under fire. Well, I don't blame people for that, because you just said there's a guy who really deserves something, so you had to find something to pin it, you know, to say that would get by the people who had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't blame anybody for that, but in any event, it showed that Simmons had ordered that he get one, and that was it. Simmons had him promoted to a brigadier, and he got this transferred to the 5th Armored Division and was made a brigadier commanding the infantry brigade. Simmons then took off for Northwest Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Kitching commanded this operation for a few weeks or days before I got there. And it was a total failure in every respect. Now, Creer only got there either coincidental with it or shortly thereafter. But he didn't like the looks of it, I guess. So he got from the British Corps headquarters, he got on loan two majors who the Corps commander said were expert tacticians. Sent them over there to analyze the battle,
mm-hmm,
and how it had gone. And they produced a report on this in a very short period of time. I mean, it didn't take weeks in those days. It'd take about 3 days or something, maybe, because we were in action then, being shelled every day and that kind of thing. Things went on pretty damn fast. You didn't dawdle around doing things. So it was only a matter of days. When their report came through, Kerr saw it, signed it, and wrote on his own hand on the bottom, "All staff officers to read this report."
Mm-hmm.
Well, to me, that was Kerr's attitude. He had a great faith in the staff, and the staff must know what's going on. In any event, you read it, you made your hair stand on end. It was just one mistake after another, all the way through, and every damn one of them was the commander. Like, for example, at a certain period in the time, at a certain period in the battle,
mm-hmm,
one section, I think it was the left, had got up on the heights where they were told to get, you see, as far as they were to go. And the other two, the middle section, had not got there quite, but were almost, and the other section had got bugged down and weren't anywhere near it. Kitching threw in his reserve behind where he was bugged down. Well, this is the worst possible thing you can do. You always reinforce success, and you don't reinforce failure.
Mm-hmm.
The result was, that these poor blighters up here were immediately subject to a counterattack, and they damn near all got wiped out. Whereas this thing never got off the ground. Everybody had to pull back to where they started. It was just all the way through the commander that was responsible. There was nothing wrong with the troops in any of these cases in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just terrible. Now, okay. The next thing happened. A message came through from from London, making Kitching a major general and to command the 4th Armored Division. Well, Crerar just about had a fit. And he sent a real blister back. All this study hadn't got back yet, but he said, "This is the greatest mistake you've ever made. This guy doesn't know whether he's coming or going."
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, in the operations office, you got to see these things. And somebody said to me, "Hey, geez, you ever see that one that Kitching got from you when the commander sent off? You see him going there? You just make, holy smoke, you say, this guy, once he gets there, they're going to shoot him."
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, Simmons insisted that he wanted him for the divisional commander of 4th Armored Division. Now, this is my story, the way I've heard it all.
Mm-hmm.
When they got in action, again, how I heard it, Simmons was totally dissatisfied with what Kitching did, because as I understand it, he was told to attack, and he said, "I haven't got enough strength. The enemy's too strong. I won't."
Mm-hmm.
And Simmons says, "Okay,
you're
on leave from now on." But now, it not only illustrates the, I don't blame Kitching for all that. It's just I don't have a high opinion on it. He was pushed in beyond his capabilities,
mm-hmm.
his understanding. You can't hate the fellow for that. Mm-hmm. Anybody could have had that done to them. But really, it showed me one thing that I will say about Simmons over and over again is he is a terrible poor judge of personality and character. And that's just another typical example of him totally unable to gauge a person. I think I put it down to the fact that he was unable to see when a person was a yes man or not.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people deal with him who had a totally different idea than Simmons had when they went in to talk to him about it. As soon as they got Simmons' idea, they'd turn it around for their own. Simmons would say, "Gee, there's a smart fellow coming in."
They could be easily manipulated by those who were quick.
I think he was. He just didn't have a kind of distrust that you
need.
That I think you need.
Yeah. So someone like Simmons would have been great as a divisional commander when he could have authority over the action.
Terrific, terrific. So.
But once elevated to corps or even, say, to army level,
he's still just as good. Oh, yes, I wouldn't. No, he was, as far as laying down, I'd give him full marks for having fired Kitching when he did.
Yeah. But the trouble is, when he's at the position at a corps level, he has to have people under him who are competent enough to allow him to delegate authority to them. And apparently Kitching couldn't or wouldn't push as Simmons wanted.
That's right. Well, I wouldn't comment on that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Was Kitching a good staff officer when you worked with him?
Well, I'd have to say no. On the other hand, I would have to say again that he gave me some of the very best advice I ever had in my life, and I'll come to it.
Mm-hmm.
He had a degree of insight into the problem which might have always escaped me, and therefore I owe him an awful lot in that respect much later. But when I, when I was at this job of the ranges to do, he was one of those guys who never left his office. As far as I could see.
Mm-hmm.
And the ranges were always being bid for. We had lots of ammunition to fire, but the trouble was to get onto a range to fire them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Brits are always very helpful. They let you have Sundays and holidays and things like that, and they put on their troops during the middle of the week. And even our own troops were bad enough because the ranges would be allotted and so on, and our people wanted them, were always bidding for them, never getting enough. And I forget now how I got wind of it, but very often we were asking for ranges. And there was nobody on the range, and we weren't allotted it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I made it my business to go to the range and see what was going on the period that he told me they were busy. The British were occupying them that period of time and so on.
Mm-hmm.
and they weren't. So I used to argue with him, and I don't think he liked it very much. I wouldn't have either if I'd been in his position, because I used to say, I went there and there was nobody on that range. Now get up and fight for the British over these things and get us some ranges.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you can't push the British around, things like that. Of course, he was a Brit himself, you know. He was court-martialed out of the British Army or mm-hmm. something or other, and then we gave him a commission here in Canada. It was one of our, you know, silly thing to do in the first place.
Well, he needed officers, right? He had training. Overlook a little bit, I guess.
Well, it was a bad business anyway.
Do you know why he was court-martialed?
Well, wait a minute. I didn't say he was court-martialed. He was kicked out.
Well, he was in the Indian Army in India, wasn't he?
I don't remember that. Yeah. But he got kicked out, and the British never forgave us for it, for keeping him on, especially... And you know what we did? Eventually, we sent him over as the major general in charge of all our military in London.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, he's divorced. He couldn't be invited to any of the royal affairs. And we went and sent him over there. In first place, the British military were most annoyed because they kicked him out and we picked him up and made a hero out of him.
Mm-hmm.
Reinstated him after Kitching had, or at least Simmons had fired him. And then sent him over there in that job. Well, it was, but the British never forgot that they'd kicked him out and we picked him up.
Mm-hmm. Last day you mentioned the insensitivity we sometimes... Oh. Used in dealing with other countries. That must be a perfect example.
It's a perfect example of stupidity, really.
Yeah.
Well, so much for that one. Have we got any more time? Or we
oh, for as much time as you want to use.
Well, next is Korea occurred while I was there.
Can I ask you a couple of one thing? You mentioned security earlier, and you gave me some examples of lapses in security. How was it applied at the directorate itself? Would there be someone in charge of maintaining a degree of security with the information you had? Yet you didn't touch upon that at all. The internal nature of it.
Well, it all worked fairly well, so I really didn't have any problems with it. They were...
But surely you must have set something up to begin with.
Well, there was a... For example, we had a whole security section. There was another lieutenant colonel handled all security.
Mm-hmm.
And he advised on security, or his people did, and so on. And within our own enclave, you couldn't get in or out without a pass all day or that kind of thing, you see.
Mm-hmm.
At night, one of our people had to wait till everybody'd gone and then go around and check all the waste paper baskets and all that kind of thing to see if there was nothing done. Then he had to empty the baskets, take them outside, and leave them for the cleaning staff to take away and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That was our domestic security.
And would you be allowed to take some material home with you at night to work on, or would
you weren't supposed to? But I often did.
Yeah.
That's one rule I broke very frequently.
It's funny. There was a special analger Hissey the other night, and that was one point that was used against him in his trial, that he would take top secret or at least secret material home with him, and that's quite an infringement. At least it wasn't the case.
Well, I realized that all the way through, and if ever anything happened, I'd have been for it. But I took an awful lot home with me. Always did.
It's almost necessity, I should think.
Well, either that or you expect to have to move your bed into the office. Yeah, I'd work all day Sunday, something like that. You didn't want to go to the office where you had to. No, I broke it, but I wouldn't let anybody else. I would have come down like a ton of bricks on anybody else. No, I couldn't do that. We didn't have any sort of searches when you left or anything like that.
Tell me, the directorate itself, where was it situated?
Right in that old temporary building, it was called, across from the Lord Elgin Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
There were three buildings there, A, B, and C. I don't know, there must have been about 3,000 or 4,000 people altogether in the Army, Navy, and Air Force.
And the section you were in, was it detached from the rest of the building? So
we were in a corridor.
Mm-hmm.
Offices on both sides, both ends of the corridor were blocked off. And at one end was blocked, the other end there was a security guard.
And would you have to check in with him before you...
Yeah. There were, as far as we knew, our security then was good enough. I always worried about some of my people.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to get suspicious, but if a person starts to do something that you really alerts you. You begin to imagine things almost.
Mm-hmm.
And at one stage, I went to the RCMP, the security section that we knew where it was the section that was watching the Russian embassy, all that sort of thing. You know, they had people there with binoculars watching them in the house across the street, all that kind of thing. Well, I went to that section and I said...
Is that the watcher service?
Yeah. I said, now look at... what if I've got some of my people that I think ought to be put under surveillance when they're off duty? Can you help us? And they said, look, we'd like to, but unless you've got prepared to lay a charge against them, we won't. You've got to have some evidence, you see. Well, I never had the kind of evidence that I would have justified.
Feeling and intuition with it.
Well, there was one officer in particular, of course I won't name him, but I began to find that he knew the Russian line extremely well, and there were very few people that did at that time, and he would defend it quite...
Something more than simply a devil's advocate?
Oh, yes. At least I felt so. And the reason for it was, I don't want to do too much, the poor guy's died since, so I didn't know that much, but we sent him over to London on a special... he had a degree, and he was getting his M.A. This was a deal they had worked up at that time, and I don't remember. Anderson ran it all.
Mm-hmm.
Sent him to the London School of Economics, which is a terrible hotbed of communism.
Yes.
And he went over there, and when he went, I saw him numerous times when I was there. When he went over, we're great friends. He bought his sister a car when he was over there. So he wired back and said, look, would you go and pick up the car for my sister, take her down and get all that sort of thing. We're great friends.
Mm-hmm.
When he finally came back from there, I felt that he had been pretty well brainwashed.
Think so.
This was my suspicion, and I found I got into all kinds of arguments with him.
Political arguments.
Basically political, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like he would come up with things. Like he came up with one time, and he said, "Well, yes, of course they." He was working on the Soviet Union, see, in his own work, in under me.
Mm-hmm.
He came out and he said. About, yes, the Soviets have what they call in their strategy the political factor, and so on. And he was very much the sort of professor type to talk down to you. And I said, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. That's when the Russians held off entering Warsaw, and they let the Nazis murder all the underground there before they moved in. We said, oh, no, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that at all. No, sorry. And you almost get the impression that he was on the Russian side, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were an awful lot of little things like that that I began to say, hey, now, wait a minute. This guy had never criticized him, you see, from then on. He used to. Never did. Remember what he talked about? We were getting a lot of deserters at that time, in the West. Mm-hmm. Not ourselves, but in the West. They were... The Russians sent a questionnaire around their forces in Germany, and they said, fill out the following questionnaire. Do you want to stay on where you are? Do you want forever? Do you want to stay here for a short period? Or do you want to be sent back to the USSR? Sort of right away.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who said they wanted to stay there was immediately sent back to the USSR. All the rest were left there. But as soon as they smelled it, you see, in the communist world, you smell things like that awfully fast. A lot of these people just realized they'd had it, so they took off. They mm-hmm. filled out the form. They just took off and went to the West, you see.
Yeah.
So we're getting a lot of those. And in the process of it, they told you an awful lot about how, of interrogation, how told the West, now we didn't have it, but how the Russians functioned, you see, and so on. And... very much along the lines of it was dog eat dog among the officer corps to try and be the best man and to get up there, and if you could stick your knife into somebody else, it made you one up. You weren't just not stick your knife into people and get up on your own. Boy, you had to stick your knife into a lot of people in order to get up there.
Mm-hmm.
The old saying in the Communist Party, you before they'll accept you, you have to declare your grandmother or your mother is a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'll accept you, see. It's the same kind of a deal all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So he started in one time on what the Russians call the new man, which is supposed to be the creation of socialism untainted by capitalist sins and evils and that kind of thing, you see, and so on. I said, I know exactly what you mean, the new man. It's this business of sticking it into somebody before you'll get promoted, you see. Again, he incensed very much, and he said, I was joking, really, but that I knew his line as well, but it was that kind of thing that I got awfully suspicious of him. Never did prove anything one way or another, but I often wondered if he really was, which side he was on. I don't think he knew anything much to tell anybody.
Well, what did he stay with intelligence?
No, he got out. I left before he did, but he got out shortly thereafter and went to external affairs, which is another thing that just scared the hell out of me at the time. Yeah.
Well, from everything I've read about Russian infiltration, they tend to want people who will take on anti-Russian ideas and who will say anti-Russian ideas, as opposed to someone who is voicing Moscow's chain of thought. I mean, that's too obvious.
Yeah. Well, I know what you mean. Yes, it might have been that he wasn't at all, but he was certainly hep on their propaganda. I don't suppose he was necessarily recruited. He just been susceptible to this,
mm-hmm.
because there was he told me before he been at this course for more than about 6 months. He told me there was a place where there's a hotbed of communism all the way through,
mm-hmm.
and in all the student discussion groups and that, they were all much pro. So he picked up a lot of that, I think. Whether he'd actually betray anybody, I don't know. I suppose not, really.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only kind of security worries I had, and I had several others along somewhat the same lines, which I was rather worried about.
Well, tell me, would your people have to be vetted by the Army or the RCMP?
Yeah.
How thorough would it be? Because I assume you would be vetted as well.
I was indeed. When I was vetted before going up there, I went back to the Niagara Peninsula on holiday to see my parents or something early.
Mm-hmm.
And every friend I met said to me, hey, the Army's really interested in you these days. They had combed over my background from start to finish, and every Tom, Dick, and Harry who'd ever known me had been asked about what I was like, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to Ottawa, I said something or other to Anderson or someone. I said, he's a really gave me a going over in this thing when they explained about it to me, inducted into it all. And the fellow who worked on this later got to be a very great friend of mine. He said there was somebody, I forget who it is now, I can't remember, but anyway, they cleared somebody. It turned out to be an awful mistake.